This is an NPR Music interview. On the day before releasing his 18th studio album, High Hopes, Bruce Springsteen drove from his home in New Jersey to a rehearsal space on the west side of New York City. He was in town to play with the E Street Band and guitarist Tom Morello for the first time since the holidays, and he walked in cracking jokes about the traffic on the George Washington Bridge. But first, he sat down for a one-hour-plus interview with NPR Music's pop critic, Ann Powers.
Let's start by talking about the title track and how the title track frames the album in a way. It's a cover, it's a song you've done several times in your career, and the album as a whole, it's a new album through which you reflect on a period of your career, which I would sort of mark starting around the Rising,
yeah,
maybe.
It's a mixture of things, you know, where just music I had that I liked, and I've always got many songs running around looking for homes at all time. And I'm always trying to figure out how to give them one, you know. And, you know, you make a record and like I said, over the past decade, we recorded quite a bit, but not quite in the style that we had in the 70s and 80s, where there were enormous bodies of work that never saw the light of day or songs that never came out. I mean, there's just so much stuff still in the vault, you know. So, but the past decade has been, you know, Brendan was, he had a more structured environment. In other words, we didn't record something until we were sure we were going to use it on the record, or very, very sure. So we didn't go down and record 30 songs or 40 songs. You know, I fooled around. Well, basically, I would demo things at home, see if they were worth bringing to his attention. And then I would bring them down to Atlanta where we recorded, or he'd come up to New Jersey sometimes. And we would select a relatively small body of songs and decide, and usually anything we selected, we already knew we were going to be able to make good records of. So that really changed the process a lot. And I think The Rising was 15 songs, and there may have been a few outtakes, you know, not many, you know. The same thing with Magic and Working On It. Those were all records that we just simply didn't have a large body of outtakes like we did. I have demos at home, but this group of songs were songs that sort of, they, you know, this one would have got on, except Down the Hole would have got on, but Empty Sky got on, or Harry's Place would have got on, but I'm not sure. I think we're considering that for Magic, but you know, some. So these are songs that just sort of just slightly slipped out.
And, it's like a parallel universe of Bruce Springsteen,
you know, a little
music.
Bit. So they were all things that I liked a lot that we were planning to have on records, and just missed, you know, for whatever the reason might be, you know.
Some of them you recorded in the past, though, yes?
Yeah, there were a lot of unusual things where, like I said, we have American Skin, which I cut live.
Tom Joad, obviously.
Those were songs. Well, the past couple of records I tried to... Well, on Wrecking Ball, we got Land of Hope and Dreams out, which was, like I always say, if I have a song that I feel is really one of my best songs, I like it to have a formal studio recording, because I believe that something being officially released on a studio record gives it a certain authority that it doesn't quite have if it comes out on a live album or just a part of your show, you know?
Right.
So those were two songs that goes to Tom Joad. The version that I do with Tom was sort of my original realization of it. I originally wrote it as a rock song for the E Street Band, and we didn't quite pull it off. And that led to the Ghost of Tom Joad acoustic album. But I always had in my mind that, you know, that was its inception.
Right.
That was its original, how it was originally conceived. So we started to fool around with it on stage. I came up with a version of it, and then Tom walked in one night and just exploded the boundaries of the thing and turned it into just something else, you know. I want that on a formal studio recording, and I want American Skin on a formal studio because I think it may be one of my best songs ever, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But it certainly it needed to be represented outside of the sort of context it was originally presented in, and I just still feel deeply connected to the song, and I wanted it to. You know, so then you have to get very good studio recordings of it, because
right.
The problem you have then is you probably have very good live versions of those things.
Right.
And so you have to come up with something that equals or betters that in some way. And that can be very difficult. We spent a lot of time on Land of Hope and Dreams on the Wrecking Ball album because it was difficult to match or beat the live version. And, you know, we played with it rhythmically, we played with it arranged mentally, didn't know if we were going to get it, didn't know if we had it, and then Bob Clearmountain came up with a mix of it that suddenly presented it to us, and we said, okay, that's great. So that's...
Well, that actually, you know, I've been wondering about that. Like, when is the click moment for you, especially with these songs that maybe you are revisiting or were just demos? When does it become not just revisiting something from the past, but you're like, I'm in a new place, I'm in new territory with material I've had for a while?
Well, to make it, it has to sound very fresh. You know, it has to sound like you know, you can't just sort of copy the live performance, because it'll kind of lay there. You know, the live performance has an audience and it has the band kicking on, you know, firing on all eight, and so it's not about going in and performing what you did live, though the version of American Skin is pretty close to our live version, but then Tom enters the picture and he just does something slightly different with it, you know. He just creates a certain ambiance. And also Ron Aniello, who's my current producer, goes in and he just, you know, it's about subtle things in the rhythm and little loops we may use. And it just suddenly it begins to breathe a life of its own. And I go, okay, this is going to sound really good on record.
Do you have to let go at some point? I mean, do you have to step back? Your own ego has to retreat and allow for these collaborations.
I never let that happen. But what I have gotten used to doing is I do delegate a lot more in the studio than I used to, which is nice, because I don't think I could work the way I did in my 20s when we had a little bit of the blind leading the nuts, you know, the half blind leading the blind, and that we all went in and just recorded until a record happened, you know.
I remember reading you would be sleeping in the studio in your coat.
It was terrible, you know. In truth, it was awful, an awful way to make records, but it was the only way we knew how. Everybody simply suffered through it, and the endless hours, I can't begin to explain, you know. But
we thank you for those hours.
Yeah. But it was just what it took at the time, you know. So, and I didn't, you know, I was just very, very much more controlling at the time also. And so I was always there and I always had my hand in everything. Where today now, you know, it's like, and it's very similar even with the live show, where I've, over the years, I've gathered a team of people, where you find people who you know that when you leave will advance your thought processes and then come up with things that you would not have thought of. And you can come back then and you can edit what you feel is great and what you feel might not work. Brendan O'Brien kind of invented this for us in the modern era in that it was very simple. He was the producer. I was not the producer. I was not the producer because I did not have to produce well anymore. You know, that I kind of ran out of steam in the 80s. And you need people who are making a lot of records with a lot of different groups, young and old, who are very current with the way records are sounding at a given moment and are also creative with it. So really, when Brendan stepped in, he had an idea about the way that the E Street Band should sound in the studio in 2000.
And you could be open to that. You felt ready.
Well, yeah, because I had no idea where to go next. I had gone in and attempted to record the band in 1998, and it just wasn't very good. You know, it just the nice thing that came out of it was the version of The Wall that is on this record. You know, that was cut at that time, but everything else just sort of laid there. You know, it just wasn't exciting. You know, and so Brendan was the guy who kind of reignited our recording process through a very different sonic landscape. You know, he brought us back to some of our roots, and that we recorded on 24-track tape with the bass and the drums. And he just had a way of recording things that made things sound exciting. And he made you excited then, you know. So then I excitedly went home and wrote more songs to bring back. And once again, your producer is always your first audience. So, you know, Mr. Landau has been my first and primary audience for many, 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 many years. He still is. But your producer is also your first audience. He's the first guy you play the song for. He's the first guy you are seducing with the music that you've written. You're trying to get him excited about what he thinks he can do with it. And then it just, you know, it just starts to become very cumulatively explosive, you know. So Brendan was a new audience. I had to go down, and he was very different than Mr. Landau, in the sense that he never asked about any of the lyrics. That wasn't his primary concern. The entire time we cut The Rising, we never mentioned what the album might be about at all.
Really?
No. Huh. And all we did was go in and make the music, you know. And he was just, if it was exciting coming out of the speakers, and he had an instinct for lyric in that he said, no, we need another line here. We need a chorus here. We need something that rhymes with orange or whatever, you know. So he had an internal instinct for what felt right, you know. But
I wonder if it's voicing. Like lyrics, I find it shocking that you never talked about the lyrics, especially on that album, which to me meant so much for all of us, but also was a shift for you into a new phase of thinking about your main subject matter.
Right.
But voicing what you're saying, it's not like the written word, it's what's coming from your mouth.
We probably would have talked about them if they were bad, you know. I think generally he would say, whoa, you know, if something wasn't up to, you know, that, I'm not sure that one's working, you know, or that line. But it just meant that part of what we were doing was okay, you know, it was acceptable. And so then we moved on to trying to do the same thing with the other things. And that would be just the pure performance and sound of the band. He was very performance oriented. You wouldn't perform a lot. We would play things six or seven times maybe.
maybe less, depending on what we had going. You'd only sing it that many times. You wouldn't sing it a lot. And we made those records in about 3 weeks.
Wow.
And, you know, mixed them in a week. So all of those.
Like the Beatles or something.
Yeah, most of my records of this past decade return to the way that we cut Greetings from Asbury Park. And Greetings from Asbury Park was cut in 3 weeks.
So, wow.
And that was generally Brendan's style. His style was, he could do it another way, but he would grow impatient if something wasn't working out. And rather than sit there and dwell on the myriad reasons and also the simple reasons for our existence on Earth, mm-hmm. rather than do that, he would say, let's try something else.
It was a practical.
Let's go to it. Okay, let's move to something else. And mm-hmm. we would simply move to another part or another song. And then we would come back and revisit it on another day, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a very different recording process. And it was one that I needed because I had to get out of my own way by the end of the 90s. I simply needed to remove myself from the technical aspect of the recording process. Mm. Let somebody else do their job, do what they're very good and well known for.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd produced Pearl Jam and Rage Against the Machine. And those were good archetypes for where we wanted to go at that time. You know, I felt I had a band still had a lot more to say. We had a lot of currency in us. We had a new voice, and I needed someone to help me present that. So he was very, very critical, both in all the many, many things that we did not do that we had done previously, and in new things that we needed to do that we didn't any longer know how to do well ourselves.
Well, just on the subject of 9/11 and the Rising and the song Down in the Hole on this new album, which to me is one of the centerpieces, I've wondered if that event, I don't know, when you think about artists, there are some times in their careers, Picasso with Guernica, Aretha Franklin with the death of Martin Luther King, their lives are changed by a moment in history. Their artistic vision is changed. And I'm projecting onto you that perhaps...
I think I'm more like Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein. That might be... I think we better take it down a notch. All right, go ahead.
Fair enough. But, but do you think the world is different now? I mean, obviously the world is different, but how is the change in America after 9/11, how has that impacted your writing and the period that this album, High Hopes, reflects?
I live here, so I was interested when I was very, very young. I decided that I was going to catalog my times, because that's what other people who I admire did. That's what Bob Dylan did, that's what Frank Sinatra did, Hank Williams did, in their very different ways. You know, the Beatles did, the Rolling Stones did. So I enjoyed artists that engaged in their world and then created some reflection of it that people could meditate upon and think about or so that was, you know, it was contextualized the times you live in to assist people in making some sense of a generally chaotic
mm-hmm.
you know, so that was just, to me, I was just continuing along doing what I was doing, you know, but I also happened to come from an area that was very hard hit in 9/11. Monmouth County lost a lot of
first responders,
a lot of good folks, and you know, that worked up there, and so it was very, very present, and you know, you knew women who lost their husbands, and you know these are people who I'd known quite regularly, and so it was. It was very, very much a part of our area, you know, it being an area where so many people commuted, and so that had I'm sure that had something to do with it also. And I mean, the day that Twin Towers were burning, I drove 10 minutes from my home, and I stood on the Seabright Bridge, and they sit right in the middle of that bridge. When you stand in the middle of that bridge, and there it was, and. You know, you could, the entire skyline turned yellow and gray, and you know, it was just something. You know, you were there, and so,
I was there. I was in Brooklyn, so I totally remember. On Down in the Hole, your kids are credited as singing backup on the song.
This is hilarious. My daughter the other day was signs. She had to sign a release, which, of course, I doubt she remembers even doing. I think she was 8 years old when she did it. She's like 20 now, you know. But she said, "What is this?" I said, "This is your recording artist. Come on, you have to like sign this." "Really?" "Yeah." "Oh, cool." So at the time, I was looking for Patty sings fabulously on that track. First of all, she just did amazing things with her voice on it. And then I think I was looking for, the kids did some sort of very ghosty part behind her or with her. And they were very young, but at the time I recorded them on several things, some of which haven't been released, but were just, they had a beautiful sound, the three of them, when they sang together at that time. And occasionally they still do. So I just brought them in and said, "Okay, you know, try this." And they put the big headsets on and they took a swing at it and they're on the record.
Song comes every morning, but it ain't no friend. I get dressed and I go back again. Rain keeps on falling, twisted bones.
To me, it works so well because it's a song about, I mean, is that person searching for a family member? It brings your own family into it. I think it's very powerful. So,
it was just, it was a nice thing for them. And she was excited. Oh, but she had, like I said, it was an actual form. I'm not sure she gets paid, but
in this day and age, who knows?
But
let's talk about your other family, the band. And I mean, the band has grown to many, many members now. And one of the interesting things about this project is it is, in a way, a conversation with yourself about past material, a conversation with Tom, but also across all the members of your band. And I'm just wondering about that dynamic right now and thinking about how it has evolved over the past decade.
It's just the best it's ever been, you know, and we were very lucky. You know, we most bands don't work out. You know, it's a small unit democracy is a very, very difficult, very, very difficult. And as you can see, there's very, very few exceptions. I think you two are perhaps the other version where it works. I've seen it work. And they're all exceptional people, you know.
It's true.
They're very different, you know.
Yeah.
I met them when they were very young. Matter of fact, I was 30, so gosh, they must have been kids at the time. And they were very different then.
For you two, I think there's a way that the band is a sacred unit and keeping it going.
And there was a bit of a Christian streak that ran through what they did, and so they're a different bunch of guys than you usually run into, and so they've had the temperament to make that work, and also they're very, very interdependent.
Yes,
and that's a key. The wonderful thing about rock music is even if you hate the other person, sometimes you need him more. You know, and in other words, you know, if he's the guy that made that sound, he's the guy that makes that sound. Mm. And without that guy making that sound, you don't have a band, you know. And so sometimes that keeps bands together in a way that's nice for us. It's probably very hard for many of them, you know.
I think of the Everly Brothers, you know, fighting, feuding, but I mean, they
couldn't. Well, everybody, Everly Brothers, Sam and Dave, Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, it's the rule, not the exception. The rule is that it's very obvious. I mean, you're not really family, but you're kind of. It's almost worse, you know, because not only you live together and have to work to be. The only way I can explain it is imagine if the people you went to high school with, you have worked with those same five people that were in your math class. And you're 60, and those are the same exact people that you work with every single day of your life, you know?
And sleep with them on a bus.
Yeah, so there's, or in the same bunk, in the same beds for many years. So the opportunity for over-familiarity is very great.
And, definitely.
And, you know, so it's, but it's kind of wonderful the way different groups work it out, you know, and even though it's difficult, but it's just, that's what a band is. A band is that thing, whether it's Creedence Clearwater, whether it's Rolling Stones, whether it's The Who, the two young guys, the guys from Oasis, you know, it's like, it makes for very, the Kinks, they all, it's all a history of, but yet there was something that each guy did that was not replaceable.
Is that,
you know,
why
it was not replaceable?
Is that why you definitely included Danny and Clarence on this recording too? The voices had to be there.
No, they just happened to play on those records, you know. And our band was pretty lucky in that, you know, we I got signed as a solo act, so mm-hmm. we weren't a democracy. We were kind of a relatively benevolent dictatorship where you could hear other voices and take them into account. But at the end of the day, it was okay with everybody that sort of, that the decision always came down to being what I felt was right, you know? Mm-hmm. And even then it was very, you know, we had our own difficulties and we stopped playing together for 10 years, partially because I'd run out of ideas as to exactly where to take the band next. But also I think people have been a little tired of one another, you know, and which was just a normal thing to have occurred, you know,
yeah.
and we were still in our late 30s and there's so many small things that enter into it. So when we took the decade off, when people came back, people realized, oh, this was like one of the best things in my life. And this guy over there, you had new respect for everyone. I had new respect for the band. I had experience playing without them. And I said, well, no, these guys are elemental mm-hmm. to something that I do. And I think it went all around. Everybody looked at the other guy and said, oh, I think we need that guy. And then gave that person, people gave both each other more room. And at the same time, a lot of the smallness disappeared because everybody realized it was just unnecessary. And we've had the greatest 10 or 12 years, in my opinion, you know, as far as just a living, working band that we've ever had. It's why the band is as good as it is on stage. And, you know, when Clarence passed away, it was obviously very sad, but I know that he was very, very happy the last decade that we played. He loved playing. He loved performing, and that we were able to get back to do it and do it for the 10 years that we did it was a wonderful thing for the two of us. And I know that he was always just concentrating on the next gig and how he could make it. And so we've been very, very fortunate. Part of it was by design, in that, you know, we were not a democracy, right. So we didn't fall into, you know. But we were not, it was not just a guy with musicians. We were not a solo act either. We were something in between, you know, and that in between thing has been what's made us special. And it's been very exciting.
The thought of an in between space makes me want to talk about gospel music. And I know that you had an idea of doing a whole gospel project. We heard some of it on Wrecking Ball, and we hear it on this album with Heaven's Wall. I'm a great student of gospel music, and I can see where that kind of call response thing and really like the preacher leading choir and
the
that
preacher
really
was
seems...
That was where James Brown came from. The preacher was the original front man. It was the shaman, you know, if you go back. You know, I mean, that was the original unit that functioned like that, you know, whether it was in church or whether it was tribal, you know. So, you know, the front man kind of grew out of that thing. And so it all gets thrown back to roots in the blues and in gospel music in church.
But what was your idea for a gospel project? Because I know you've talked in the past about getting this religious impulse to work in a way that it's not restrictive or judgmental. You know, we talked about you too. They do a similar thing. And I hear that in songs like Heaven's Wall. And even in some of your protest music, the version of 41 Shots that's on the album, there's a lament quality to it, you know, and a trying to transcend.
Yeah, well, without overusing the word, you know, there's a Christian element that runs through it, because I grew up Catholic and so I was indoctrinated in religious language between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock every single morning for the first 8 years of my schooling. Every 5 days a week, every single morning, your first thing you did was religion. And so you grew up with that language, and it was, of course, distorted and screwed me up terribly. But at the same time, it would made for good writing, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful source of metaphor when you went to write about the world and about your inner life. Mm-hmm. And it served me. I suppose looking back on it, I would like to change some things, but I wouldn't have had that any other way, in that it's served me very, very well and continues to do so. I have a deep connection to gospel music. I understand the language. I feel I understand, the essence of music itself. I had an interesting time. Jay-Z and I performed together for President Obama in Ohio, and we were both on the same bill. I was playing acoustic, and he had his group, you know, and the audience was filled with some of his fans and some of my fans. And this is a big arena. It was like 20,000 people, my fans. And then there were actually some people probably who'd come to see the president, right? So I'm coming out first, and I'm going to play acoustically. And it was, but, you know, and I think I did Promised Land and maybe Land of Hope and Dreams. And it was fascinating as I watched the crowd, who I knew a lot of them had not heard my music before, but who understood the language I was speaking in, because it was very gospel based, you know, if you'd Promised Land. So, and the issues that were involved. So that was, it was a fascinating afternoon. It was a great afternoon for me, because I got to stand on stage and watch a lot of people sort of, you know, and there were young black kids, and there were some older black folks, and it was very multi, the crowd was completely, it was very, you know, multiracial, and it was just a great afternoon, and I got to watch people sort of experience some of my songs in their bare bones and for the first time, you know.
And see the thread between what you did and what they had learned coming up in the church. And
yeah, it was just interesting, you know. I mean, I was boring some people, and some people I was exciting, you know. But it was just a nice moment. So that background and that language has served me well, and I'm sure I can't not draw on it now. It's in the bones and the skin and the bones of my writing, and that's the way it goes.
Well, you were talking earlier about how you and Brendan have worked with beats, or I know on some of the songs it's loops by Bruce Springsteen, and this shows an influence perhaps of hip hop, or at least of the technology of hip hop. And I wonder if at some point in your listening, because I know that you listen to everything, and you're one of the things I treasured about your South by Southwest talk that you gave was how you erased genre, and you said, we should embrace everything that sounds right to our ears. And I wondered if hip hop was something at some point that kind of the light went on for you and you got it, or how does that work in relationship to you?
It was so present, you know, and it was, you know, it was at one moment, you know, particularly it had White Lines, and this was stuff that was talking about what was going on the street, you know, and in the inner cities, and you know, with people who were struggling, and that was something that, I mean, I had my own context for that, you know, that I wrote about it in my own way, but it was the music that came along and gave voice to those things, outside of what was then considered the a protest music context, you know, mm-hmm. and did so really beautifully, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm not well versed in it, but I have listened over the years, you know, Public Enemy, Notorious B.I.G., I listened to Tupac, I listened to Kanye West. Kanye West is incredible, you know. I mean, the record making facility, you know, there's a lot of hours in those records, and they're.
He's a perfectionist like you.
No, they are. I mean, somebody's. You know, there's like the just the production and the and. I saw him on television a little bit. He did a song called "Blood on the Leaves" on this later with Jules Holland. It was fantastic. You know, it was. He's very. I still find him very interesting. So it's just, you know, it's. I'm not necessarily driving in my car. You know, I probably right. fall back on the stuff that, you know, I listened to as a kid or something if I'm driving around or.
How about country music?
But I do listen. I listen to it a lot because there's a lot of information in it, and it's just fascinating record making, you know.
Well, the dual side or the flip coin of hip hop might be country, and you know, Hunter of Invisible Game. For some reason, that song gives me a Hank Williams feeling.
Well, maybe, you know.
The loneliness, yeah. You know. I don't know, but I know you love that kind of roots. Country, and I wondered if there was a way that you were still feeling that. That was a particular period in your history too, I know, when you turned to that music.
Well, country music is kind of where rock music has gone, really, at this point. You know, it's basically kind of pop rock music. You know, it's where rock music continues to have a certain currency.
It's true.
You know, so it's kind of fascinating to hear country music now because, with the exception of the twang, occasionally in the guitar and the voice, it's very much sort of like 80s rock music or something.
Mm-hmm, I know.
And it's an interesting genre because bad country music is some of the worst in the world, you know, but great country music is some of the best. And there's a lot of, my daughter got into a lot of new country music, and so she would kind of play it on the way to school on occasion. I got into a lot of some of the new guys. You know, there's a lot of talented. I mean, I like some of the Toby Keith records. Kenny Chesney.
Toby's got that working man's thing.
Yeah, and when he gets the song, when he's at his A game, it's really good. You know, it's it's like anything else. When it's done, you know, it's. I mean, I'm probably as far as. I'm still back with George Jones and Conway Twitty and you know, Lefty Frizzell. I mean, that's sort of my go-to, but there's a lot of good young country guys out there. I wish I had my. I should get my. Let me get my computer because yeah. I have all my stuff and I don't remember everybody's name. Yeah, could you get my bag? Because there's really, I have a lot of different. Playlists and things that I
would love to know what you're listening to now. But I'm wondering, you know, just that sort of sense of loneliness in that song, particularly Hunter of Invisible Game. I wonder how you cultivate that mood of like solitariness. It's always been such an essential part of your music for me.
That's not hard to do, you know. That's my fallback position. in life.
Is it really?
In life in general.
I would have thought you were kind of a team player in some ways, but
that took me a long time. The team wasn't so interested in me. I'm crashing my computer right now.
Anyway, durable
so
Mac.
It took a long time to sort of go there, you know. I had to get used to being good company for myself for a long time, which is good because every artist begins as a angry, isolated outsider in one way or another. I don't know anybody who's started some other way that I can think of. I mean, maybe there is, you know, but
I don't know. I'm thinking about R&B and soul like that. Sometimes
you're right. I think that might be those roots might be different because they come up out of community and church.
Right.
So, I think that. that's a very different context. But I think for a lot of young, well, certainly blue collar, but young rock musicians
and male musicians. Yeah. Let's just point out. I mean, that's a very the solitary male. You know, that's definitely an icon in rock music.
Yeah. I've worked that one as hard as I can. You know.
Well, while you're looking, I want to just quickly ask. I'm really curious about the song Harry's Place. Can I ask a specific question about that? It's about the production. To me, it strikes me as almost psychedelic.
Downtown hipsters drinking at the drug line. Down in the kitchen, working in the coal mine. Got a special sin, mister. You can't quite confess, messy little problem. Maybe baby need a new dress. Razor back diamond, you shine too hard.
It's a fantasy song to me.
It is.
People always talk about Bruce Springsteen as a naturalist, you know, telling the real stories. But I love your dream
from Asbury Park.
Well, I know. I mean, yes. I love the dream aspect, you know, of what you do. And I'm wondering if you can talk about what role fantasy and dream plays in what you do.
It's everything, of course. I mean, that's all we're doing, really. We're living in the world, but it's all sort of dreams. It's all illusion. It's theater. It's not real. We're making up stories, you know. And you know, people tend to run into you and believe your characters. And I suppose the funny thing is, the longer you go, you do become sort of some version of them. Huh. You both diverge from them. You know, you live, but you also, you know, you also permanently inhabit that geography and that mental space, and so you do morph a little bit as you know, we sort of there, you know, we do become what we imagine, and certainly this is the place. America was the place where you go and do that.
Totally.
You know, and I mean, really, my thing was very, very unusual. The characters in my song are really my father's life. You know, it's not my life. You know, my life. I mean, my life was inside Llewellyn Davis with a happy ending. You know, I was that guy.
Yeah.
I was the guy sleeping on the couch in Midtown and taking the subway to Greenwich Village, and I kind of caught the last tiny bit of the folk boom, and you know, I auditioned for John Hammond at the Gaslight.
Huh.
I met David Blue. David Blue took me to meet Jackson Browne at the bitter end when he was promoting his first record, and then he took me out and I met Odetta and I opened for Dave Van Ronk at Max's Kansas City, so I caught the very tail end of that thing, you know, with John Hammond.
But then
a lot
you were
of people.
But what about the punk side? And which is not, you have a suicide song.
I caught the beginning of that because I would open for Dave Van Ronk, and if I missed my bus back to New Jersey, I had to go back to Max's. And when I went back to Max's, at 1 or 2 a.m., the New York Dolls were playing upstairs.
Wow.
And I'd never seen anything like it, you know, and they were great, you know. And so it was, I sat at this in the strange fulcrum between both something that was at its very end and something that was really just beginning. And so I saw the Dolls. This was 1973, I think. It had to be, because I was playing solo acoustically. I mean, it was very, very early, you know, or four or somewhere in there, you know. And
that's the right period, I think.
And so that was all going on downstairs. I never became a part of the downstairs scene at Max's. I just sort of took the bus in and went and did my gig, and then I would run to get on the last bus back to New Jersey.
What about Suicide and covering Dream Baby Dream in a way that I think Alan Vega never would have done? I mean, let's be honest.
I just loved them when I first heard them, and I loved him, you know. I still think he was the cross between sort of, it was futuristic and visionary, and yet it was completely authentically rockabilly, and he was like Elvis, if Elvis had been, you know, been sort of born in the mid 70s or something, you know,
right.
So they were always, and he was incredibly, really, he just manifested something that was always very mystifying and
scary
and raw and very sexy and very, very rebellious. And they were very brave.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they were very provocative in their day, and the audiences, I'm sure, you know, took it out on them from time to time. So they're just gutsy. It was just the real thing for me. And I wasn't going to, you know, I mean, that wasn't where I was making my day, but it was something that when I heard it, it really moved me a lot. And like I said, I think they should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Hopefully it'll happen.
I think they're very, and they're becoming more influential as time passes. I think this group of Savages just did cover the Dream Baby Dream also. So it's,
you know, when you were talking about how we become our fictions and artists become their own fictions and people do, but then thinking about the Ghost of Tom Joden, especially 41 Shots, and thinking about the Trayvon Martin story of this past year, you were also speaking about people who don't have a chance to transcend their fictions. And I wonder if those kinds of stories interested you more in these recent years.
Well, I just think that when you kind of grew up, I believe everything that I've written about kind of comes from the psychology of my childhood, in the sense that I lived in an interesting house. And I've said this many times, you know, I lived in a house where somebody was very fulfilled by their work, and in a house where somebody was very lost mm-hmm. in the workplace and struggled very hard to keep their head above water. And it was a house that you know, was the finance company kept us floating from month to month, just barely, you know. So I saw that happen, and it was a bit of, you know, sons and fathers. I think somebody asked T-Bone Burnett once, it was Rock and Roll, Daddy, you know, it was like somebody crying, Dad, you know, the whole sons and fathers thing. It'll never stop, but I suppose it's somewhat boring at this point in time, the bottom line is it just is. And so right. I think the funny thing was, when I went to work, you know, I've said in the past, what did I do? I put on my father's clothes, really. Mm. I didn't put on my clothes. When I began to craft a larger image, say, than the one that I started with in the early 70s, I very much crafted it. And I used to have a funny dream, you know, where I would be in the audience while I was playing.
Mm.
And I would somehow end up wandering down the aisle, and I would come to my father's seat, you know, and he would be sitting there and with my mother alongside him. And it would be in the middle of the arena while the show was going on. I remember kneeling down, and I would say, Dad, I says, and I would point to the stage and say, that's you. I said, that's you. I said, that's how I see you.
Huh.
You know, so that was just...
That's a very classic American literary. I've been reading John Updike lately. You know, I feel like it's in that kind of mid-century novels as well, the crisis of trying to figure out your place in a lineage. But the songs on this record, the political songs, especially working with Tom, who's so political, I wonder if you've changed to think about broader identities beyond this one focus on your own.
I think Tom's very active, you know, much more than I am, he's just a fascinating character. But Steve had a whole stretch of where he made nothing but political records.
It's true.
Now the funny thing is, Steve and I have gone full circle. Steve in the 70s in the Southside Records says no politics in music, that's a mistake, he says. And you know, the guys have often credited our first trip to Europe and Steve is often credited as turning him around politically, because we went to East Berlin, you know, and this was in 1980, and it was pretty grim.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was really grim. And Steve has always said that trip going through Europe in the 1980s affected him, and he then made political music for a decade and continues to be
celebrated.
Very, very active, more than myself, you know.
Recently, the death of Nelson Mandela reminded us of what he did.
In some city. So I've had that around me for a long time, really. I had Steve and then, of course, Tom. So it just means we fit well together.
Right.
And we find a place where we, you know, have a lot of commonality, and we draw from that. And I mean, Tom suggested High Hopes, which really kind of sits in with a lot of that music.
Right.
I think he dug out Hunter of an Invisible Game too. I think Brendan had played that for him at some point when I wasn't in the studio, maybe because Brendan produced Tom also.
Oh,
you know?
Right.
So he, and then just, you know, those are places where he and I naturally gathered, you know.
Right.
And I gather in different places with different members of the band, which is why the band is so nice at this point. It's lovely. I have so many places to go to. Everybody is underutilized. So the thing I have to apologize to the guys is, like, I've, you know, on this tour, we have four great guitar players.
Right.
You know, I mean, everybody really, with the exception of me, subsumes their ego to the greater whole, you know.
Suze has some great moments on this record.
Patty's records have been completely, in my opinion, completely underrated. I mean, if people go back and listen to the last record she made, Jesus, it's played as a laser. I thought that the writing in this, it was like Dusty in Memphis, you know. It was just lovely, lovely record and great singing, you know. And so everybody sort of is, and I have to thank them for it, because they come on and everybody comes out and they work as an ensemble at my service, and it's a gift that they give me, and it's very nice.
We need to wrap up shortly, but, you know, I wanted to ask you also about Frankie Fell in Love as a potential live highlight.
Wake up, boys, wake up. You drunken cry, boys, shake it up. How Juliet says Romeo spin fan. Frankie Fell in Love. Well, peace, don't break out. From here on in, we can take out. She ain't gonna be cooking for the likes of us. Somebody go, mama, just tell her. Frankie Fell in Love.
It's such a fun song. It's that classic. I can just see the crowd rocking to it and everything. And
We're hoping so, yes.
Are there songs like that that you know you're going to bring them into the room and it's going to become a moment?
Yeah, and sometimes that doesn't happen.
Have you been disappointed by your own songs?
This one is going to, people are going to love this one. And you go out and you play it and it's like,
no.
Okay,
way.
That was all right. You know, I had some, you know, just, it's like, I mean, you don't always, you know, you're not always right. You know, sometimes, I mean, I had songs that I thought were going to be like, sort of become part of our really the body of the set, and sometimes they did, and sometimes it doesn't mean that they weren't great songs. They just, you know, they're just, or maybe I didn't present, and then also songs have lives that where they don't truly reveal themselves for 10 years later.
Like what?
Like it was the Tom Joad, or you know, which suddenly, you know, became a very large song on our past couple of tours. You know, so
right.
So songs reveal themselves at different moments, when you maybe have a chance to interpret them better, or sometimes you go, oh yeah, man, this one's gonna kill live. I can't wait till we get out and play this thing live. And sometimes that happens. Doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes you get out there and you play it, and it's just, you go, well,
you see a dull look in the eyes of the audience.
It's just you don't see sort of the explosion you thought was going to occur. But we'll see, you know. So.
What
we'll
about
see what happens.
The Saints song that you covered? I mean, you were in Australia when you made this. So the Saints, I loved it because I have a friend who has a son named Bailey after Chris Bailey. No one ever knows who he's named after. I was like, yes, you're covering the Saints. But I also wondered, that's a band that's very influenced by Bruce Springsteen. When you cover a band that's influenced by you, are you in dialogue with yourself?
I don't think they were, you know. I mean, they started out as a pretty hardcore punk band with I'm Stranded. And then later they made the lovely record that Just Like Firewood was on, which never reminded me of me. It just reminded me, I just thought it was great. And I loved that song, you know. So
right. It's a great song.
But, you know, everyone steals from everyone else, you
That's
know.
The business.
And stealing well is there's a genius to it. You know, when it's done well, I mean, I can hear groups that have been influenced by us, but they're themselves, you know,
right.
They're who do beautiful work. You know, it's like, I have a close friend, Brian Fallon from Gaslight Anthem, he was a fan, but he he does something, he just manifests something that's completely his. I've played with his band on stage a few times, and I love doing it. You know, it's just, it's wonderful. You know, we played in Asbury Park at Convention Hall one night, and we did American Slang, and it was just great. You know, it's like, hey, you know, you hear little bits of this, but then it's somebody, they take it to another place. They take it to a place where you wouldn't have taken it, you know, and that's what you hope for. You know, when you're playing, you hope that someone hears your voice, is interested in what you're doing, and then gathers whatever they think might be of value in it, and then moves it down the line. And you know, we're all part of sort of that, you know, being a musician is Patty and I often discuss it. It's a wonderful thing. You're a part of a long line of the continuity and of wonderful things and people who've made magic and enlightened, you know, enlightened people and excited people and changed the way people thought, looked, dressed, acted, behaved, thought about themselves, thought about their country, thought about their town, thought about how they want to be, who they want to be. Against me, they got just heard a song that is Black Me Out. The name of the song is a fantastic song, you know. And any time where you feel, you know, you dropped a seed or two that someone picked up in any way it's just a pleasure, you know. It means like, oh yeah, well I did that little part of my work well, you know,
right.
And that this was assistance and someone went and made something beautiful of their own or crazy of their own about it or you know, whatever, however it comes out, you know.
It's that gospel impulse we were talking about, that connecting, you know, making a line through history.
I mean, you go down, I mean, I'm sure, you know, I mean, we do the Secret Sessions band was very, you know, I could see doing a gospel record with that group of musicians, you know, with Oh Mary, Don't You Weep and Jacob's Ladder.
I'd love it.
You know, I'd love to do a project like that at some point. And you know, so it you never know where something's going to go. And it comes up when you, it comes up in places where you'd least expect it. And that's where it's always the most fun.
That's what we want.
It's always quite wonderful. So. My computer's still working after I crashed it. Okay.
What do you
Traveling
see?
Alone, Jason Isbell. I believe he was a part of the Drive-By Truckers. He got a lovely solo record out himself. There's a gal called Katrina Train. Kristen, wait a minute, let me see. Hold on. I'm going to plug some people here because I love their records.
I love that Jason Isbell. It's one of my favorite records of the year.
Slim Dunlap is fantastic. Not a lot of people. He was a part of the Replacements, and he made two fabulous rock records that were just really deeply soulful and beautiful. And
I think he had a stroke not long ago.
Yeah, I believe I don't know what his health condition is at the moment, but I know some folks were cutting some things. I hope I get a chance to cut one of his songs because he's just, this stuff is, check out the two Slim Dunlap records because they're just so beautiful. They're just beautiful rock and roll records. They're so deep. I found them to be deeply touching and emotional. Christina Train, very Dusty Springs. She got a song called Dark Black. That's fantastic. I love that. Let me see who else I can plug here while I'm rolling.
Do you like Eric Church? Have you heard his song Springsteen?
Yeah. My kids thought it was hilarious. Dad, there's like a song. The song like your name is in it. And it was a good song too, so it was nice. I wrote him a letter. I said, "Man, you know, we all got a kick out of it." You know, it was a lovely song. It was fun.
What was cool about that song is it did use your name, but it wasn't like a tribute to you. It was just about how they listened to you while they made out. You know,
sweetie. That's as good as it gets. You know, I mean, the verses were really. We're really lovely, wonderfully done, you know. And so you're thinking, you know, you're thinking of the guy in the 80s and you're making that music. And, yeah, that's what you want to be, the music someone's making out to, you know, at least you hope to be, you know. Yola Tango, Tears Are In Your Eyes. I just recently discovered that. And I just kind of recently got into them and they're fantastic. And
they've been one of the indie mainstays of Yola Tango. Absolutely.
I know.
Jersey?
Know.
They're from Jersey?
Yeah, I know. But there's, you know, Phosphorescent. I like what he does. Bonnie Prince Billy, Gulf Shores. I got tons of stuff. But anyway,
If you want to give us any like classic soul R&B stuff you've been listening to that love. I mean, I know that we could name the expected, but can we go off the beaten track?
Something that's a little different. All right, Eighth Day. Check out Eighth Day. She's not just another woman. You got to crawl before you walk. I like, of course, I got done. I have a thing here somewhere. That is.
When you listen to blues, do you tend to like Bobby Bland style urban blues? Are you more into the country blues, or is there a mix?
I like both. Yeah, I like both of those things a lot. You know, it depends on the mood you're in. You know. Gene Chandler, Gonna Be Good Times. Not a song a lot of. Do I Love You by Frank Wilson. A great, not that well known soul song. What else have I got here?
I feel that you become a more soulful singer as you've gotten older. Like, that's become something I hear in your voice. And I don't mean that just to like butter you up. I'm just saying.
Well, I'm still a pretender, but I'm getting better at it, and my voice has actually gotten better. I can sing a little more in tune as I've gotten older. I think the older you get, the deeper you slip into some of those roots, or perhaps you just with age you gain more in common with actually the people who made some of those records. Because occasionally, if I get the right song, I can do okay with it, you know. We do this song called Back in Your Arms that there's a nice version we did on the last tour where like, yeah, I'm getting pretty close, you know. It sounds pretty good.
I felt like Girls in their Summer Clothes was a song like that too. It had such a classic sound.
Oh yeah, that's just a fun, that's just great. That was my, you know, Spectre pop.
Exactly.
That's a song I thought people were going to love. You know, well, a lot of people did, I guess.
Me too.
didn't become a big part of our show, but it was one of my favorites of recently, you know. Yeah, what else you got there, kid? Anything else?
I'm looking to see.
Or am I going to go rehearse?
Anything else we want to cover? Yeah, no, we should.
Anybody, shout out questions. That's why we're here.
Well, I mean, we talked about the band, we talked about the religious stuff I wanted to ask you about. You know, I have serious questions and I have fun questions, you know. I like the fun questions.
Let's do those.
A little better.
Ride Your Pony, the Flesh Tones, great garage version of Ride Your Pony.
I love the Flesh Tones, they're awesome. I guess one thing I'd ask you just in fun is like, you've talked about you and Tom having this thing. It's like he's inspired you, but I mean, a lot of it just seems like you're having so much fun with him, and like he's an unpredictable performer. Have there been like, what's been the most surprising thing, or was there a moment on stage where you're like, where are we going with this?
Yeah, well, you know, musicians, like I say, they don't call it working, they call it playing. There's a reason, you know. You haven't actually worked an honest day in your life, you know, or you may work, you know, you may play very hard and perform very hard, but it's don't kid yourself. And so, you know, so it's, and Tom just comes on and yeah, he'll start. Sometimes I don't know where he's going. And, you know, he just, you know, the thing, Jackson Brown came backstage and said, "Hey, Tom Morales, that's funny." He says, "You know, E Street Band builds a pretty big house when we go out there at night." And he says, "Yeah, you know, Tom Morales, I'm like, he builds some other room on it." And I think, yeah, that's what he does. He builds another room. In other words, he just brings things sonically in that we haven't had and don't have. And those things are surprising. And somewhat, you know, he's a visionary guitarist, you know.
You also let him sing on the record, which was
He sings real good. You know, he's got a baritone. He's not a tenor. He's a baritone voice. And when you catch the right thing, he's a powerful vocalist. He really, you know, he really makes it work, you know. And so he kind of takes the band sonically someplace that really the reason the record I think exists is I had that material. If I hadn't, you know, and he came on and he kind of brought something to it that moved it to another level and made it feel like, oh yeah, this is current, and this is something I'd like my fans to hear, and it just brought it into a tighter focus and made it very exciting. So,
is there a spark? Is there something on this record that is sparking the next project for you? Or are you not in that headspace yet?
Everything is always doing. I have, you know, 5 or 6 different projects I'm working on that are, some of it's archival, some of it's new, some of it's kind of in the vein of songs like on this record that I've had that I'm trying to find a home for. It depends on what I'm able to realize next, you know. It's sort of like what we do next will depend on what is bringing itself to a conclusion or to fruition. Some things I need to write some songs, and it depends on what comes up as you go. You know, I don't know, some things will happen on this tour. I don't know what's going to happen yet, but things, we may at one point have the entirety of the E Street Band on stage, possibly in Africa, which would be fun. And because that's a mighty unit at this point. You know, now we have an open door policy where people have other lives and do some things, and
Television stars, things like that.
Yeah, and that's worked well. But we'll I don't know. You never know what's going to really, where it's all going to go until you get out there. And
Jake's working out well on the horn.
Yeah. He came in and very gracefully took an impossible position, and it was part, but because of, well, he understood who Clarence was, what he meant, what those solos meant, and. And he was just, he's who people felt who he was the minute he stepped out, you know. He's very smart, but also very soulful young guy. He makes lovely music of his own, but deeply understands the band and the stakes that we try to play for. And that was very important because, you know, I got DVDs by a lot of guys that could play Circles Around the Moon. And I sat there one morning, and Patty was sitting there, and I was going, nope. It had nothing to do with the playing. Guys were playing their asses off, you know. And I knew what she was saying. She was saying, you know, it's like, no, this is, it has to somehow remain family in some way, you know. And particularly, I think Clarence would have, he mentioned Jake to me a few times and said, I have a nephew who plays very well. And, he brought Jake with him on tour, didn't play, and he just kind of hung with Clarence, and they, you know, I think he might have, looking back on it now, he might have had him there. I think it was when Clarence wasn't feeling that well. So, you know, it was just, we were, somebody up there likes me. That's all I can say.
What's that lineage thing? And I guess this is sort of how I'd like to wrap it up, and asking kind of a hard question, which is that you have said in that Rolling Stone interview, in certain recent interviews you've given, you keep mentioning this image of the light at the end of the tunnel. Now, I have to say,
why would you not?
You are one of the more fit performers that I have seen, you know, much more so than it's people like, 25.
It's like the guys that keel over during the marathon. You know, they're fit too, I'm sure. You know, but it's like, hey, man, no one knows what tomorrow brings. You know, that is the only thing I know. Once you're my age, there's quite a few folks missing already, all right? And from 50 on out, and it only increases as time passes by. I lost my two great, great aunts this year. My mother lost her two sisters. They were the living, breathing connection to the old world in Italy, and they were a core, you know, it's I can't explain it. You know, it was an enormous loss. They were amazing people. And, you know, not to mention friends who, not to mention people who struck with really serious and often debilitating illness. You know, it's like, it's just a part of your, reach a certain part of your life, and it becomes a part of your life. And you know, I lived with Clarence for the last decade when, you know, he struggled to get along, you know, and Danny, I don't have to, you know, also, so, you know, it's just a part of the day, you know? And so I use that image as motivation for sort of, I'm a bit more interested in working now, perhaps, and working rather, luckily enough, we've developed a system now where I can work on a lot of things at once. I can, successfully delegate things and without, you know, and still maintain this the essentialness of things. The East Street Band goes in the studio and cuts things in seconds. And so it's allowed me to speed up the process of our releases. And I just have a lot of music even just sitting around and a lot of other things I want to do. And so you realize, I believe the band's going to be playing for a great deal longer, all right, but not forever anymore, as you felt when you were 32 years old. You realize, okay, there's a finiteness. There's a moment when, now when I go out and we go to Europe and there's a new group of 16-year-old kids who I know are seeing the band for the first time, or I meet people in their mid-30s and 40s, never saw the band till 2000, you know, who I've seen it 50 shows already. And so now when I go and I see these really young kids and we get a lot of them overseas, you know, I realize these kids who have never seen the band with Clarence, who have never seen the band with Danny, and they will outlive us by many, many years, you know. And so tonight is our night with them. And so you're playing for an audience who will significantly outlive you now, which is kind of both wonderful and bittersweet. And I look forward to doing that a lot longer, you know. So
Leonard Cohen is still going.
Yeah, and I want to. Yeah, and he's fantastic.
Oh my God, he's better than he was. I can't. No, 3-hour shows. He might top
wonderful.
You in
wonderful.
Terms of length.
Yeah, you know, and so, you know, there's people out there that hey, look, I played with the Stones last year and I had a wonderful night, and they played great, and it was just lovely having them on stage and seeing them there, and it meant a great deal to me, you know. So those are things. It's part of the landscape, you know, and it's nice. It gives you a little extra motivation to, and also my kids have kind of all slightly moved out of the house now. So, you know, you have a little bit more time. And,
so the rehearsals can go all night long now. You're not keeping the kids up.
They could, you know, if we wanted to. I don't think anybody wants to anymore, you know, and we don't need to, but I think that it's like, wow, I have all these things I'm interested in. I would like to put something out every year. You know, at this point, there's no reason. On this first contract I signed, I was supposed to put an album out every 6 months.
That's how it was, right? I mean, the Beatles.
Hey, put I'm out every 6 months.
Yeah.
That was what you're supposed to do. That's how I signed. I agree. You know, and the first year I did,
yeah.
You know, and so like, I would certainly like to put a project out a year. And
do you look at Pearl Jam and bands like that do a lot of things on the internet? I know we were talking, yeah, you talked to someone about that bootleg series type stuff.
Yeah, we're looking into doing more of that also. You know, I think I'd like to get an archival series going in some way. I'd like to make things more available through the internet. The internet has become our friend, you know, and in that we went to South America, haven't been to South America in 25 years. We played for a lot of people. And I guarantee very few of them had ever seen us before, but I was shocked by how knowledgeable they were about the band the first night we went into Santiago, Chile. And I realized, after a few songs, I realized, I got it, the internet. In other words, if you're anywhere today, you're everywhere. There's no such thing as being, there's no such thing as having not gone someplace anymore, you know? And so, you know, we sold 40,000 seats like the first day in Johannesburg. We've never been there, you know, so, but you've been there somehow because somebody wants to come and see you. So it's sort of those, the internet now is something that, I'm becoming very interested in and trying to find ways that of just, you know, getting more music out there and staying a little more. I mean, I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not tweeting. Somebody tweeted. I think I have someone that tweets for me.
You're not going to do, you know, song. You're not going to do a song a day.
Real men don't tweet or something. I don't know something. Someone has tweeted in my name.
Do you have concerns? I mean, there's some musicians are concerned about piracy or issues around that with the internet. But you seem to be very eager.
The idea is that you have to stop. I knew that when the smartest man in the music business that I knew was selling headsets. I knew that you're going to have to stop worrying about that completely.
Yeah.
It's like my buddy Jimmy. I mean, Jimmy, what are we going to do? Hey, Jimmy, what are you going to do about the music? I'm going to sell headsets. You know, it's like, and you know, so it's a situation where you're always concerned about it. And look, and I think for somebody like me, it's a lot less of an issue than I had some friends who didn't have a label, who put their own records out. And if they sold 50,000 of those records, it kept them in breakfast cereal for a couple of years, you know? And so I think those were guys that got hurt by the decrease in record sales from internet piracy. And I remain being one of those guys that believes you should get paid for your work. So I'm old fashioned in that. But at the same time, it's there and it has many benefits. And the idea of, I think we live more in a grateful dead world, and the idea that everything you do is recorded now, and that's okay with me. You know, it's like matter of fact, I believe on this tour we're starting to do something where you can come in, you can buy a band, you can get a copy of the night show. So hopefully we're going to do that at a really nice quality level. When it happened, when Sirius Radio said they were interested in doing a station, they said, what can we play? I said, you can play anything you can find. I said, whatever, if a fan sends it to you, says, if you want to keep it interesting, simply play anything you can find. So we came from the polar opposite. We started out as being very, very controlling. Now it's just a different playing field. And so it's exciting. We have our little website, and we've been throwing some things from the last tour. I get to, right. If it was a great performance that night, you know, somebody can mix it quickly. We got a guy who directs the show great, and suddenly we caught a version of New York City Serenade from Rome that I was just so glad we had. You know, it was one of those things that, like, it was just a perfect night. We had a string section, and the guys played it beautifully. And I was just like, when I saw it, I'm just so glad this exists. You know, wouldn't exist if we weren't thinking about it, getting it out that way and doing those things. So I'm looking forward to expanding and using more of that in the future. And hopefully our fans will enjoy it, and it'll give us another canvas to paint on.
But there's still nothing like being in the room with you, Bruce Springsteen.
Well, you know, that's the nice thing about that is something that, any film performance and a recorded performance, there's something about a live performance that like when I last time I went to see Bob Dylan in Monmouth College and Long Branch, my little neighborhood, I just was enjoying being in the room with him. Yeah. You know, it was just fun. I was just enjoying, literally came out, I just enjoyed being there, you know. And that's something that it's not replicable. It's recordable, but not replicable.
I agree.
And
I feel that way about Aretha. If I can be in the room with Aretha, I'm
it's
happy.
Nice, you know. It's nice. I saw Elvis in his very last days. He was when he wasn't doing well. I saw Elvis twice. Once when he was in doing great at Madison Square Garden, first time he played in New York, and another very close, a few weeks from the end, when he played in Philly. And there were moments of brilliance and moments when he wasn't doing that well, but occasionally something would happen where you go, that's Elvis Presley, you know. And I'm sitting here and I still remember it. So. Anyway,
on that note, thank my you friend. Got a rehearsal.
Yeah,
thank
okay.
you so much.
Thanks
I really
everybody out there.
It.
Enjoy the record, and we'll see you on the road.